have a couple of questions. So that's Amanda Stewart there too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So one question is the first piece, which indeed it did sound electronic, and I was surprised it wasn't even processed, right? It was actually her voice with no process. So that is interesting to know. I'm surprised, and this may be just a coincidence, but I would have been fascinated if I had seen her face when she was making the sounds. And the particular thing you showed was just the audio with a picture of her. Is that piece meant to be a performance piece where you study, where you see her face? Because that, to me, that would be really, really interesting.
Amanda's one of those artists who never documents her work.
Really?
I took that.
Right.
I took that on my phone. Basically, that's why it's so bad. She's just, you know.
So basically what you're saying is really live. You have to be there.
You have to be there. And you know, trying to get images from her for the book was almost impossible because, yeah, she never documents it. So it would have been great.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen her perform. And she calls it, she says that she becomes this kind of grotesque creature and she just stands and sometimes her fingers twitch a bit.
Yeah, I can imagine
it's
really gripping to see it.
Yes.
When she does it live.
Yes, yeah.
I have a couple other quick questions. You didn't use the word prosody, but I guess a linguist would use the word prosody, you know, in terms of pitch and rhythm and all that kind of stuff. It strikes me from just, you know, everyday experience that if I know someone really well and I talk to them on the phone, I can tell you an enormous amount about them because I have a baseline. I know what they normally sound like. I can tell you if they're angry, sad, upset, if they're a little not, there's someone in the room they, you know, they don't want to hear what they're saying. They have a cold, you know, all the millions of things that we humans can decipher. If I don't know the person, of course, it's far more difficult to decipher. So I think it is certainly true that you have to be really familiar with someone to get all the details, maybe, that you can. That's one comment you can comment on my comment. The other thing, sorry, to finish is the real estate agent is a funny example. I guess I would say, again, from everyday experience, that we don't trust salespeople. And we don't trust them partly because they're obsequious and they pretend to like the same things we like.
Yeah.
So if you write a computer program that does that, of course you're not going to like it.
Yeah, yeah.
So you need to be a little coy, basically, and not just do the obvious salesman-like pitch. The other thing salesmen do is they use your name a lot. They say, Andy, you know what I mean? And there's all these cliches that you can put in a computer program that will immediately sound obsequious and false.
Yeah.
But with a little extra effort, you could start to get much better at it. And so I'm just interested in your comments on why they did make it so obvious. Was that on purpose?
Well, I just think that's a happy coincidence in terms of developing a critique. I mean, it seems really strange that they would do that. But just to go back to your first question.
Yeah.
We have to remember that we have shaped our voices to speak on the telephone, and we've had decades of practice at that. So how often do you use sarcasm on the phone? How often do you speak in a whisper? You don't. You know, you, especially with cell phones, you adopt a certain mode of speaking, which allows for maximum meaning to come through without there being the sort of noise of disinformation or whatever. So in the same way that you wouldn't try, you know, highly complex sarcasm on somebody that you don't know because you don't have that baseline there, you wouldn't try a really high voice or a really low voice on the phone because you know that it's going to distort or it's not going to transmit. So we've already shaped our voices. Our voices are already kind of audiophonic, if you like. So we already have that sort of in the background. The other thing about that I was going to say about the building trust, you know, and that we all hate salespeople, is that particular conversation, you know, where Ray discloses that she doesn't like her own voice, that it's a technician's idea of a voice, is a really interesting choice of thing to say, because it's not just about, you know, so building trust, it's also about Ray, the real estate agent, the software agent, pretending it's not media. You know, I'm not media because I understand my own voice. Pretending it has a kind of sentience. I can critique the person who made me because I don't like that voice. I hate microphones. Like, I mean, this is like a sort of a robot in science fiction film saying it doesn't like the way it was designed. You know, it's like it's a demonstration of sentience and consciousness. So it enables Tim to lock in, as soon as Tim has this kind of conversation, Tim is locking into this fantasy of consciousness already there within the autonomous agent. So I think that's really, really interesting, because it's a sort of a confession, not that, you know, the ECA loves tiles or the ECA has a headache or whatever, but the ECA does not like its own voice. Its voice is a construction. So,
yeah. One quick comment before we go on to someone else. I think it's very ironic that in the interest of convenience or whatever, we have very much accepted a tremendous degradation in audio quality. That is to say, a landline in 1963 sounds far better than a cell phone in 2014. So according to your view of things, we've adjusted to the horrible fidelity of cell phones. We repeat phone numbers when we're leaving a message because they're garbled. We barely communicate. And I remember when I first started using cell phones, I would say to the other person, you know what, I'll call you back on a landline.
Yeah, yeah.
And now no one does that because no one has a landline.
Yeah,
so we have accepted this lower quality, just as in music we've accepted the quality of a laptop speaker.
Mm.
And we used to have really nice sound systems in our house.
Mm.
So it's a weird thing that we've actually gone backwards in terms of fidelity, just for convenience, really.
Mm.
So does that? How do you view that? Is that something we've also adjusted to somehow?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, over the years that we've accepted, and remember when the cell phone came out, you know, that it was so, or the smartphone, not the cell phone, the smartphone. The smartphone, I think, was connected, especially the iPhone, was connected to a whole range of, you know, cultural gadgets and what I call iCulture. But in a sense came with a rhetoric that was so strong that to not accept it seemed to be, or to not be able to use an iPhone seemed to be some kind of inadequacy on your part. So there was a sort of, you know, I mean, the rhetoric about, oh, well, you know, babies can use iPhones because they're born that way. I mean, it was really strong, and Apple were very, very sort of persistent in making this something that was so identifiable with youth culture that in any sort of problem that you might have with the technology was seen to be somehow you're outside of this, you know, particular culture, you can't deal with it. So it was a real sell.
Thank you very much for your interesting talk. I found particularly interesting that point that you made about in that conversation between Tim and the real estate agent, that sort of, like, right from the get-go, Tim didn't really have a choice other than to relate to it in a certain way. And I was sort of interested in what you think that reduction of choice comes from. And because I was sort of thinking about, on the one hand, I was thinking about Alpha Saron interpolation, right? The idea that like, it's literally the hail that you kind of cannot respond to. And in Alpha Saron, it's ideological, but other people have brought out the effective and aesthetic dimensions of that. And so that's sort of one aspect of it seems to be, or possibly is, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about that. To what extent is this an ideological framework?
Yeah.
The other side, however, is especially when you mentioned sort of like speech codes and social codes, I was thinking about Spinoza's the one that jumped to mind, but a number of people who sort of point out that, you know, we assume ourselves as the measure of other things, and that there is this human tendency to anthropomorphize.
Yes.
And so given anything that even vaguely
mm-hmm.
sort of, you know, gives us a human face, either literally or enough that we can glean onto it, we have a tendency to project that.
Mm-hmm.
And then social codes of politeness sort of bring in
mm-hmm.
questions about how we relate to other things that we think of as human.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I, you know, those were two streams, and I'm sure you have thought of other streams, and I'm just curious about what issues are going on in that moment of having no choice other than to respond as if to a human agent or to a whatever agent.
No, that's a great question. Audio means to hear and also means to obey. There is a kind of, etymologically, to listen is also involves some kind of obligation. So the obligation in listening to someone, especially if they address you, is to respond. There is an automatic obligation to respond. So I think it's very interesting that, and this is a big, I'm going to make a big sort of leap here, but it just so happens that, you know, Ray, as I mentioned, was developed around 2000, developed as a real estate agent, developed as a piece of software that would help sell homes. Go back to 2000, 2002, maybe even 2005, it's the beginning of the subprime crisis, housing crisis, not the crisis, but the build-up, you know, the housing bubble in the US. The housing bubble, we've got to remember, and I know, and this is addressing your question, so just yeah. The housing bubble came after the dot-com crash in 2002. The dot-com crash came after a huge bubble, a tech bubble, and also a huge development of discourse and rhetoric about the new economy and the information economy and the information superhighway, and remember Clinton, and you know, everyone was sort of selling this new economy, this new, these new gadgets, this new way of living, the living, you know, the immaterial, the virtual, and so forth. So when the dot-com crash happened, Greenspan lowered interest rates to virtually zero, first time for a long time. There was never really a recovery after the dot-com crash, just another bubble. So here we have a real estate agent. Now, this is more figurative than actual, but here we have a real estate agent, a software agent, an autonomous agent, who is, in a sense, failing, but the motivation is there for it to embody the kind of subjective or machine subjectivity that was promised after the IT revolution. It was promised in this sort of era of, you know, virtuality and so forth, and artificial life and artificial intelligence and so forth. So here is the autonomous agent selling real estate. And how that relates to your question is, that this was the beginning of debt culture. I mean, not the beginning, I mean, the US has always had problems with debt, but this was the beginning of global debt culture. So you can see that conversation between Tim and Ray as a kind of a wonderful microcosm of a global situation that was happening. You know, real estate based on virtuality, based on a virtual something, algorithmically processed, and then leading into the financial instruments that were, again, sort of algorithmically based, that circulated debt around the globe in terms of synthetic derivatives and CDOs and all the things that, you know, built up and allowed for debt to be packaged and so forth. So in that very, very beginning of the conversation, there is a debt there. So what I'm, in some ways, I guess one of the things you could draw from that is that debt precedes that conversation. The debt precedes, that in the answering, in Tim answering Ray, there is already a kind of debt there. There is a debt across economies and also, as I point out in my book, across ecologies as well. And it's, I couldn't go into it now, but I think it's a very interesting point to think about hearing, responding, what we're responding to, the kind of obligation we have to respond, and the debt that subtends that, and the debt of the virtual, the debt of the post-human. The debt of the post-human preceding, in a sense, via rhetoric, the actual manifestation of any kind of post-human traits.
So, just to ask you to go on a little bit, so would it be fair to say that in your text, you have such an intriguing concept of the propagation of subjectivity and related to the notion of the development of the indebted subject. So the machine subjectivity that here you talk of, would you say that that is the form of subjectivity that's been propagated? And its characteristics are that it's disaffected, it's imperfect, it's artificially compressed, and it's become all too human. In the sense of seeing the conversation being an embodied conversational agent, the human being, just seems that it's done a flip right now. You know, we've become the artificial life. the thesis of your text, right? Say by the time you enter into a computer-mediated conversation, there's already invisible protocols at work. There's an acceptance of imperfection that Andy was talking about. There's the compression of the conversations that go on and whatnot. It's already an artificially induced conversation that takes place.
Yeah, and I think just on that, that in terms of that artificiality, that what that produces is a sort of a regime of dissimulation. Like, so we dissimulate, the machine attempts to mimic our dissimulation. You just get this constant feedback of what I've called in the book a kind of performed autism. So in a sense, it's a reductive process. It's a process that really is aligned with what is computable, what can be quantified, what can be digitalized, what can enter this kind of regime of the algorithm or whatever. And the tone of the voice is something that can't. It's very, very hard to quantify. Nobody's been able to produce an artificial voice that sounds like a human voice. It's extremely difficult. They just can't do it. So it's one aspect of human subjectivity that escapes, or has been so far escaping, this kind of regimentation. But because we adapt, we have adapted, and we are always adapting to our technologies, and because in a sense we have allowed this kind of reduction to occur, it's becoming easier. It's becoming easier to make that match and to create that simulation. Obviously the partnership is happening, but whether or not it's a beneficial partnership, whether or not it's a productive partnership, I don't know. I mean, I think there are two sides to it, and both sides seem to me to be kind of a reduction, following a reductive process.
But then what happened? Can I just ask one?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, but it would have, it has its whole Nietzschean side, though, doesn't it? Because there's a technological side to this, but in your text, it's like, from my reading, of course, you know, I just say, well, it's, when this machine subjectivity, which we've become, comes onto the stage, it's completely populated by a debt that can't be paid. And out of that comes immense, you know, the obligations that can never be satisfied, the speeds that can never be attained, the image that can never, the bodily image that can never live up to the image of the perfect simulacrum of yourself, which is on the screen, you know, just whatnot. And leads to profound guilt and anxiety.
Yes.
It crushes the person.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that that's, that's an aspect of modernity. I mean, I think that that's, in a sense, where... again, this is a really long conversation, but I mean, I think you think about the where post-humanism comes from, the ideas of, especially, you know, how we became post-human, that's interesting, but where the ideas of post-humanism came from. If you think about the science fiction, you know, genre of post-humanism, a lot of it is framed in terms of an essential guilt of, you know, humans post-modernity, a kind of a nostalgia, in a sense. It's a kind of modernist nostalgia, but there's also a sort of a very real aspect to a guilt that is timely in terms of post-humanism, which is the ecological crisis that we have. So it's not just an economic but also an ecological guilt that we bear, that has been, that in a sense post-humanism is able to latch on to in a funny way. But that debt that you mention goes right back to, you know, the debt to the divine, the debt to society, the debt. I mean, under modernism, I think it moved from the debt to, you know, the divine being or whatever, to the debt to the society, the debt to government, welfare state, etc., etc. You know, we all have a kind of obligation to the state, and we all have an obligation to society, and that's an initial debt that we're born with, which is much the same as, you know, the idea of original sin. So there you go. I mean, if you want to be born with debt, you're born a Catholic. So it's that original sort of cursing of humans for being humans.
I'm curious. I really agree with, I like that you brought up David's point in Dionysus about how we've always already been post-human. And I'm wondering if you can kind of, or if you would, elaborate the kind of the history of what you brought up really nicely, be outside of a kind of, outside of the 20th century modernist or modernity narrative, because I think there's a lot of really nice resonances, even in the way the voice is figured in opera.
Mm-hmm.
And the way there's kind of very specific rhetorical figures that develop over 400 years of opera to have the voice do certain things and have these kind of these excessive moments like the scream in Don Giovanni or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if you can kind of pull out the earlier historical precedents to the kind of machine subjectivity they're bringing out. Because a lot of the time, and I don't think your work does this by any extent, but when it's kind of framed with technologies of the last 20, 30 years, give or take, or just technologies of modernity, it's really easy to then view it as an exception of the kind of this post-human mm-hmm. machine subjectivity. I think something that's brought up now, and I don't think you would agree that that's the case,
mm-hmm.
even thinking about like in the 17th or 1820s, like the first speaking machine, the Mizell,
yes.
that Mizell made. So just thinking back to historical precedents for this kind of post-human machine subjectivity and where that falls from.
Well, I mean, one example would be the anthem, the national anthem, and what I call anthemic sort of music, which is music that is, or song, that is meant to build a kind of national pride and has been used, obviously, in fascist regimes. Now, we think of the sort of national anthem in Nazism, we think of the sort of socialist song, and so forth. But the thing about the anthem is that it's melodically usually quite simple. It's usually quite a simple melody that everybody knows and that people sing together. So this is a sort of pre-technological infrastructure. But when we think about architectures and people singing in architectures, like a church, for instance, churches have fantastic acoustics. They're built that way. So what you get in, say, a church or in a hall or whatever is a reverberative space. You get sound, the sound of many voices amplified and reverberating back. So you get a form of amplification, an early form of audio technology that Hitler used very well, by the way. He also used audio speakers to amplify the sound of voices in rallies and so forth. And when you get that kind of reverberative space, historically and culturally, there is a connection there to ideas of the infinite and an infinite resounding. So one of the things I talk about, and this is right out of audio technology, the sphere of audio technology, back to, you know, liturgy, church liturgy, and say the idea of the song of praise, the sanctus. In a lot of liturgy, you have the repetition of words like holy, 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 Lord God of da-da-da. I mean, there's a lot of repetition in there. If you have a number of people singing, like a choir singing all at once in a very reverberative space, you get a sense of praise of the divine, continuing forever. And so that notion of the infinite, which I think post-humanism has in a sense inherited and promulgated, that idea of the infinite and the infinite resounding is there back, has been produced and utilized for so long. I mean, architecture has been a way of doing that, a kind of pre-technological way of doing that. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, so just to go back to the point you made about sort of the reductive nature of this partnership. And what I was thinking of is the fact that, that it's, you're describing the relationship in terms of this relationship between sort of the human and the non-human. Not exclusively, but just to shift to that, I wanted to think or ask you to think a little bit more about the political economic, because I do. Specifically, what I was thinking of is when we talk about this reduction in language, that happens in non-technological environments as well. Like, I was thinking about how much the sort of weird, stilted, circular quality of that conversation. It's like, well, anybody who's ever talked to a telemarketer, or you sometimes see on the net those circulations of recordings of somebody trying to cancel their cable, right? And it goes on for 10 minutes, and it's this constant return to these, you know, like, the, well, can you give me a reason why you are doing that, right? And it's there is this interaction that we have either seen or frequently experienced of talking to salespeople or telemarketers and trying to sort of break through the script that is in front of them to gain access to the human themselves. Mm-hmm. And the reason I bring that up is sort of then to think about is how do you think about this matrix, or coming from a Deleuzian background, so I would look at the language I would use would be assemblage, of the partnership of the human and the non-human as being something that produces this reduction because of technological limitations, and to what extent do you have this thing of both humans and non-human technology bound up in a particular political economic requirement that encourages a reduction of affect or the channeling of affect in particular ways, such that you end up with this kind of technology and this type of human interaction?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. I'll give you an example. It's not as if algorithms are ideologically free. So, for instance, in the subprime crisis, all the algorithms that we used, all the financial instruments that we used to give people who had no income, $50,000, $500,000, whatever, to buy homes that they couldn't afford, in those algorithms, there was no factor for house prices going down. So, in other words, infinite growth was built into those algorithms. So what did that produce? Just that little something, that little forgetting to put in the factor that house prices sometimes go down, produced a whole economic and social era, a new era, a post-GFC era, where people have lost their houses, they've lost the place where they live, they've lost the roof over their head, programs have been cut, youth unemployment in Europe is about 60%, I think, in Spain, whatever. All the things that come from that, huge economic and social and political things, the entire sort of governmental infrastructure of Europe now is changing based on this calamity, this economic calamity, and there was the algorithm back there that, do you see what I mean? It's the same processes that
But just then the point that we can't figure that as like a coding error or a quirk thing. That was, as you say, like it was an ideology, right? That idea that housing prices don't go down wasn't just an artifact of a thing. That was the general, when you turned on Fox Business or whatever, and during that time, you might have gotten a slightly more nuanced, but the general gist you would have gotten is housing prices go up, right? Mm-hmm. Like that, like we don't need to worry about the alternative. Mm-hmm. And so in that regards, that political, economic, ideological framework shapes the technology such that you can only get a certain thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great example.
Yeah.
And then the sounds of the, can you just ask you another question? Can you speak then? Because in your text, you differentiate between noise and sound. So you go to Atali's noise. See, until that point, noise was seen as disruptive. And you talk about punk rock, it's great examples. Then say, but in fact, capitalism is listening intently to noise and begins to absorb the trinity of noise into its machinic culture. And it goes over to the side of noise. And so you then begin to talk about opening one's ears to sound. It sounds the prohibited, the people's microphone of Occupy Wall Street, and sometimes to the sound of the non-human world. And you have very poetic descriptions of, in fact, listening quietly to the sounds of nature, actually. as this other form of human integrity, forms of an integral experience, which has been lost. Can you?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, this in some ways goes to your question as well. So I draw a lot from the work of Michelle Sayre, and one of the things that Sayre talks about is the way that, you know, our listening has become so narrow, partly because we live in houses that are insulated, we listen to sound that comes through audio speakers, we often listen through little earbuds, and you know, the compression is extreme and the sound is terrible. So we're really hearing a very small frequency range, but also we're not feeling sound. So you go outside, you hear the wind in the trees, you feel the wind. You know, there's a sensation that is involved in sensing sound. And sound itself is something that is both heard and felt at the same time. So if you've ever been to a noise or heard noise, you can hear, you can feel the vibration. You know, it's a very, very palpable thing. So Sayre's argument is that we are increasingly restricting our sensory range and our sensual range. We're not feeling, you know, the wind on the skin and so forth. And the result of that is that our common sense or our ability to make sense is also being reduced. So in talking about listening to sound in a different way and actually exposing ourselves to sound that's not audio, basically, that's not necessarily coming through speakers, I guess, and this is where the people's microphone actually comes in, I guess what I'm arguing for is similar to Sayre, that there is a way in which sound enables sense. I mean making sense. It enables both a sensing and a making sense. And that without that sort of hearing, if we're only ever listening to the 30-second bites of, you know, media politicians, if we're only ever listening to our own rhetoric that gets or political rhetoric that gets spun and spun around, you know, the globe and that we hear through these little speakers, if that's our range of, you know, hearing, then we can't, it's a dumbing down process, it's a de-skilling process, we can't sort of make sense. So one of the things about the People's Microphone, I'm sure you're all aware of the People's Microphone, was that it was brought in because they weren't allowed to have amplification in Scotland Park. But in fact, if you think about it, it's a really great correspondence between occupying space, actual space, which is ground, which has atmosphere, which has wind, you know, in which you are able to sense, and also speaking with a kind of delay, so that there is room for reflection. So, you know, somebody speaks, and then, you know, the crowd sort of passes it on. There is room for reflection. There is actual physical space between the speaker and the group that passes it on. So this is sound occupying space. And in a sense, Nancy talks about this as well, it's a reclaiming of the ability to make sense. It's a reclaiming of the space for making sense. I think Nancy says that all space is the space of the political. And certainly now, in our current era, this is a space that's being appropriated. This is the space that is being occupied by corporations, by developers, by toxicity, by noise pollution. I mean, that's where noise is important, because one of the things that I've noticed that, you know, just think about sort of development, is that the noise occupies a place, the noise appropriates a place, and then it gets taken, in a sense. You hear the noise of machinery, and then the ground is dug up. There's that wonderful scene in Hitchcock's The Birds, you know, the opening scene in The Birds, where it's a silent soundtrack and you hear the sound of the car going into this very quiet village, and then the birds attack. You know, so it's, you know, then there's disorder, then there's a sort of end of that quiet life that the villagers enjoyed. So noise pollution is a form of appropriation though it's not recognized as such, it's rarely recognized as such, because of sound's immateriality and so forth. But yes, the space in the passing of the word is, I think, you know, really, in the people's mind, is really quite profound, because that's the space that needs to be occupied. So,
yeah,
that was a great response.
Other questions? Fran, let me think. Is there one more?
Just to follow up on Arthur's question, then, with the kind of the restricting of audible techniques that's going on, restricting digital technologies, and the way that that's kind of disallowed techniques of listening that would afford a kind of more of a sense making, I'm wondering how you would then read Stuart's as if, like, you. For someone that doesn't have a musical background coming to that piece, it's very hard work to get into. So I'm just wondering about the kind of tactics of listening that you follow or suggest, and, or whether you think that there is space to enter a work like As If, which is situated in quite a few traditions that kind of can be hard to enter.
Mm.
So I'm just wondering how you approach that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Atali said ages ago that the music heralds change. And I don't agree with that word at all. I do think there's something to be said in the idea that sound is, in a sense, ahead of change, or sound enables certain questions to be asked, certain ways of thinking to develop. And so for me, the Amanda's pieces in Noise, particularly the attempt to sound like an electronic transmission, it's like sounding the first human. There is something about it that is that enables us to enter into a thinking that might allow us to ask questions that we need to ask, or raise issues that we need to raise. So in other words, and this is where I think noise works are really, really interesting, because there is not so much, there's no anthemic quality to noise works. There's no melody, there's nothing that you can sort of, often that you can attach things to. There's just the sound. And so in getting into just the sound, there's something that could be brought from that. There's something, and this is something I find very, very hard to articulate, but all I can say is that it's in my own experience that it's through listening to those works that certain ideas come up, certain questions can be raised. And I don't know what it is, but I think it's got to do with the non-melodic, non-structural openness of noise pieces. And also... their kind of vibratory effect, the fact that you often feel them as you hear them. And in addition, the live performance aspect. You're not going to buy a CD of nonsense. They're things that you have to be there for. So it's all those things you work together.
So how does because you're using kind of a very oppositional, as I'm understanding it, definition between noise and sound in this instance. So I'm wondering, with a work like Amanda's, it's kind of thinking about granular synthesis, so like taking about a piece of sound and splitting it into its kind of its atoms, so to speak, which is something that's been afforded by digital technology. I'm wondering then how a piece that's so concerned with kind of pure sound and the particles of sound, how the definition of noise can still operate there, because in a way, you can read the piece as not being about noise as kind of not sound. And instead it's this kind of noise of materiality, a kind of a cybernetic understanding of noise as pure sound, as noise is what's kind of, and then you get those in other places, the noise that kind of underpins the materiality of sound rather than a kind of interruption. So I'm just wondering how you hold both of those, or whether you do, or how that works, how noise operates in that instance.
The way that I would answer that is just to say that noise always carries with a paradox. And that, you know, there is a paradox there's the informatic understanding of noise, there's the sonic understanding of noise, there's a musical understanding of noise. And in a sense, there's oppositions that operate all the time within all of those. So, so you can think of Amanda's piece as if as being a kind of mimicry of granular synthesis or whatever, or being composed of lots of particles. But that's thinking of a particular sound from a particular perspective, which doesn't necessarily pertain to noise. I mean, noise is one of those categories that is almost impossible to... it's almost impossible to articulate. And one of the ways that we know that it's almost impossible to articulate is if you think of the terms that we have for noise, like thunk or thud or crash or clatter, or especially noise in speech, babble, murmur, rumour, chatter, so forth. So in noise itself, in the way that we describe noise, there is a sort of contradiction. There is the repetition of a second syllable, say murmur or babble. So you get this sort of repetition almost as a way of re-identifying the sound, almost as a way of saying, well, you didn't hear me the first time, I'll say it again. That sort of... there was an inadequacy in the words that we use to describe noise, and there is paradox in the way that we think about it. So you can come at it from the informatic or digital audio perspective if you want, but that's only one way of coming at noise. And Stuart's work, I think, in this particular piece, certainly, is a way of coming at notions of posthumanism, I think, because it's really about digital technology through noise, through a particular mimicry of noise. But that's just one, and so there is a paradox there in the sense that, she has to almost annihilate herself in order to produce it. So it's an almost annihilation of the human to produce the posthuman. I mean, that's just glossing it. And that's a paradox, but I think paradox exists everywhere. That you can, whenever you come across noise, you will find paradox. Yes. And that, in a sense, is a good thing, because perhaps it's good to live with paradox, and perhaps paradox, living with paradox and thinking paradox, is one of the things that sound helps us do, and is what we need to do, in terms of thinking posthumanism and thinking politically and critically for the era that we live in. There are no answers, and there are a lot of contradictions, and so being able to think paradox is kind of a good thing in that situation.
Any other questions? That's a great question. Fran, thank you so much. That was just a brilliant work. Really appreciate it very much.
Thank you.